Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this Times LSE debate, a sort of pre-election debate tonight on the subject of education. Now, clearly, coming to a university to hear speakers from the three major UK political parties, you'd expect to hear about higher education, but I think all three of our speakers are going to range across more than simply higher education, and I think clearly questions will be likely to range beyond the narrow confines of HE and universities more generally, though I would be surprised if university governments and finance did not come up. We have three speakers this evening, and the format, as in earlier events of this kind, will be such that each of the three party spokespeople will briefly introduce for 5 or 10 minutes their party's policies, and then after that will be an opportunity for a bit of discussion here on the panel, and then plenty of opportunity for you, in the slightly serried ranks nature of the way we're laid out, to ask questions and to debate with our three contributors. Our contributors are, in the alphabetical order we've sort of decided to run in, Tim Collins, here sitting to my left, who is the Conservative MP and Conservative Shadow Secretary of State for Education. On his left, Lord Desai, an LSE emeritus professor who is here representing the Labour Party tonight, and David Rendell MP, who is the Liberal Democrat higher education spokesperson. So we're going to run in that order alphabetically, starting at the beginning of the alphabet. So if I can invite Tim Collins to take the lectern and open up. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's been a year or two since I was last in this building. I was an LSE student myself in the 1980s. And in terms of education policy writ large, I would suggest that what is needed is the application of some of the economics principles for which the LSE has long been famous. And so we need to see more choice, we need to see less regulation, and we need to see the application to a much larger extent of market principles. Taking schooling for a start, we have a hugely over-regulated and Whitehall-controlled state education system. We believe that schools should not be owned and controlled by local education authorities or local councils. We believe that all of them should be grant-maintained, running their own budgets, funded essentially from one funding stream and essentially funded on the basis of the number of pupils whom they attract. We believe that inevitably, if you have effectively a state monopoly, you get all the things that state monopolies have been famous for over the decades around the world. You end up with lack of choice, you end up with queuing, you end up with enormous inequality of provision, and you end up with a lack of performance. So we will legislate for a statutory right to supply. New providers, whether they are profit-making or otherwise, will be entitled to come in to offer alternative schooling, and parents will have essentially a voucher, if you like, although that's not a word we tend to use, but that describes the system, whereby the element of funding that would otherwise have been available to be spent on their children in a local state school can be used, if they so wish, to educate their child at a local state school, or they can take it to any other kind of school locally that has met the minimum Ofsted requirements and commits itself to deliver the national curriculum. The system that we are advocating for our schools has been implemented very successfully in recent years in Sweden, where they saw, over the course of 10 years, a fivefold growth in the size of the independent non-state sector, still free of charge to the parents, paid for by the taxpayer, but actually not owned and run by the state. And it became so popular in Sweden, so I'm told, that although it was originally introduced by a right-of-centre government, it became essential for the Socialist Party in Sweden to promise not to alter this policy before they once again became electable. Turning to higher education, we'd seek to apply some of the same principles. We don't believe that it is any business of any government, left or right, conservative or Labour, to tell universities which students they should admit. So we would abolish OFFER, the government's access regulator. We would make it clear to universities that we would not have or impose or imply any targets for what proportion of British students they should take from independent or from state schools. That should be entirely up to universities. We would hope that they would take decisions on the basis of academic merit, but that's a matter for them. If you set people free, that means they are responsible for their decisions thereafter, not you. We also would get rid of a large amount of the immense bureaucracy which at the moment constrains higher education institutions, whether it be through HEFCE or otherwise. We would simplify the funding methodologies, and again we would move much more towards, at least as far as the teaching element is concerned, funding following student preference. Now some will say, well, if you believe in market mechanisms as a Conservative, surely you ought to believe in top-up fees. Well, we don't, because the government has created a system which couldn't really be much further away from a market. I'm not familiar with many markets in which if you want to alter the price by a penny, you have to get a vote on the floor of the House of Commons to do it. That doesn't seem to me to be much of a market. What in fact the government have come up with is something which even in economic terms makes very little sense. It costs £1.1 billion for the taxpayer to give universities an extra £900 million. We would actually get rid of fees. We would replace that system by one paid for by removing the subsidy on the rate at which students repay their loans. That raises so much money that not only can you replace all the top-up fee income, you can transfer the student loan book to the ownership of the higher education institutions, thereby raising £3 billion up front in extra capital for universities, and £500 million a year for 19 years in pound-for-pound matching of endowment funds. And for Russell Group universities like the LSE, competing head-to-head with the Ivy League in the United States, doing something to plug that gap in endowment funds is essential. Now, all of the parties have some downsides to their proposals on higher education finance. The Labour Party proposing essentially to double student debt. The Liberal Democrats proposing essentially that they would fund students for 2 years. They're not sure about the third, and there would be a strong encouragement for students to live at home. And the Conservative downside is that you wouldn't have free access to student loans on a subsidised basis as now. But we would have half as much debt as under the Labour plans. We would fund you for 3 years. We would provide access whether or not people are living at home or not. And we would actually bring just a little dose of the market, which the LSE has so often and so wisely stood up for, to education principles across the board. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I should make it clear that unlike the two other speakers, I'm not in any way officially connected with the government. I'm a backbencher. And my brilliant record has been that when I was on a shadow front bench, I was sacked twice. You can't sack a backbencher, so I don't know what will happen. The way I see education, and I think the way generally Labour Party sees education, is that it's a deeply class-ridden thing. And for as long as I have lived here, which is 40 years now, and taken part in debates over secondary, primary education and other education, it's been absolutely clear that the weakness in British education is that not enough people get secondary school education, and those who get it don't stay long enough. And consequently, there are gaps in our skill portfolio. We have a productivity lag behind France and Germany, let alone not to say USA. And so one way to think about education, since most people get an education not just for their culture, but for... IT skills are low. Most people get education not just for cultural and social advancement, but also to get a job. And from the government's perspective, what they have to see that the money we put into education benefits the country as much as possible. So I think one thing to tackle, and I think this is why the government over the last 7-8 years has tried to improve the staying on rate after 16 in higher education. I think that's a fundamental weakness. Our debate on higher education about access is vitiated by the fact that basically middle class people go to higher education because working class people don't stay on beyond 16. It has nothing to do with fees whatsoever. When there were no fees and full grants, working class people still didn't go to higher education, not because of the fees, but because they didn't have the educational skills to go there. Now, how do you eliminate that? You eliminate that by obviously having some diversity in provision, and the whole scheme of academies, which has just started, only 17 academies so far, and I'm aware that there has been an adverse report from a common select committee, but these are early years. And by the time 45 academies are adopted in different areas with community support or private sector support or whatever, there will be some diversity in provision, and there will be a chance for people to take courses which will prepare them for the job market. And other improvements, like the latest statement about skills and Ruth Kelly's response to Tomlinson, are also designed in such a way that, A, we have the basic skills of literacy and numeracy, and then beyond that, people have skills which will give them employment. Now, in a sense, this is not an easy task. For as long as I have followed education, there's always been a crisis about literacy and numeracy. Labour governments and Conservative governments have battled with this, and you just have to go on battling because that what the kind of person comes out is important. Now, on higher education, I have been, without any false modesty, in the forefront of arguing for properly charged higher education, income contingent loan finance higher education. And my view of the government's policy is, and this is not a commitment on my part, not a manifesto statement, that we are only halfway there. I'm astonished that people argue for a regressive subsidy that higher education students should get. Further education students do not get that subsidy. And they are not necessarily much better off than higher education students. And I think the higher education student subsidy is a great anomaly in our system. And obviously, in half of the House of Commons thinks we've got free higher education. I can't help that. But most of them are in my party. But I think an income contingent loan is the most equitable way of financing higher education, because those who get higher education gain from it, and it's time they paid for it. So I think eventually we will get a better financing system. It will neither be a Lib Dem policy nor a Conservative policy. But I think eventually what we need is an equitable system as between further and higher education, as between mature students and young students, and as between those who have to pay taxes to finance higher education and those who are going to benefit from it. Justice requires that we stop subsidies. Thank you.
And third only because of the alphabet, David Rendell.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you all for coming along tonight. It's good to see a good crowd. I think the last time I was in the LSE talking about the subject of education was when Charles Kennedy came to talk in a room, I think, downstairs from here to launch our higher education policy. Some of you may have heard him then. I hope you did. It's been my privilege over the last 4 years now, nearly, I suppose, to have what I have often described as the easiest job in politics. That's because I'm the higher education spokesperson for the Liberal Democrats. And our policies have proved so abundantly attractive, not only to young people at university, but also to their parents and grandparents, that we've won over an enormous amount of support, and it's been, therefore, very easy for me to promote our policies on all occasions, and I'm delighted with that. I just hope that Charles doesn't choose to move me after the election, but who knows. Let me say, though, a little bit first about other areas of our policy other than higher education, which is my speciality. We were talking just now, Tim was talking just now about schools. I think the great difference between my party and the other two parties on schools is that they both concentrate very much on saying that choice is the main objective. And of course, in many ways, choice is attractive to the voter who thinks that they will be able to choose a better school for their young child. But actually, of course, what most parents really want is not choice between a number of different schools, but to have a really good, high-quality school close to them that they can send their child to. They don't want to be able to choose a school miles away just because it's a little bit better than the one next door. They'd much rather have the one next door be a really good quality school for them. And of course, as soon as you insist on choice, what in effect you're saying is that you insist on a number of empty places. You cannot really provide choice unless you provide empty places in the schools so that anybody who moves into the area or whose child becomes of that age group has an empty place that they can fill if they choose to do so. And as soon as you insist on having that degree of empty places, you get an incredibly wasteful and very expensive system, which means you can't spend as much on each child in a filled place because you're spending it on the empty places instead. The next stage, the 14 to 19 stage, is another area where we have a very significant difference from the other two because we have supported wholeheartedly the Tomlinson report. So has, of course, the entire educational establishment. It's only the two larger parties in the House of Commons which have really opposed Tomlinson. And in particular, we support the idea that the overall diploma that you get if you follow the Tomlinson proposals is one which isn't simply a wraparound for the current exams, but is actually quite a separate diploma, and the current examinations at GCSE and A-levels are not simply a part of that. We also say that the importance about education, 14 years upwards, if not before, is to have not a series of ladders that you can climb up at that stage, but to have a sort of climbing frame, so that you have a much greater flexibility between what you study, when you study it, even where you study it. And this is true not just of the 14 to 19 stage, but also, of course, of higher education itself. It's becoming more true all the time of higher education. We need to make it even more so. But higher education does need a lot more funds. There's no question about that. All three parties agree that higher education needs more funds. The only question is, how do you provide them? And our view is quite simple. There should be no fees, no top-up fees, and we should reintroduce grants for those who come from the poorest backgrounds, in order at least to encourage them to go to university. Of course, the logic, in a sense, of saying that education should be paid for is to say that everybody, regardless of how wealthy their background, should have to pay fees and should pay for their maintenance and should do it on the basis of a loan, which they can then repay later. Background, in that sense, shouldn't make a difference, because what should make a difference is the ability to repay after you become a graduate. But I think it is important to encourage those from the poorer backgrounds to go on to university, and that's why we would want to introduce grants for those people. The fallacy in both the other two parties' policies is that they claim that their repayments are income contingent. Of course, that's not true except year by year. Under the Labour Party policy as it stands at present, the government's policy, what happens is that everybody pays fees of a given level. Everybody pays those fees, regardless of what happens to them afterwards. They all pay the same fee, usually based on a loan, but of course they can pay it at the time if they choose. And they then have to pay that off out of their income. The amount they pay off each year out of their income is income contingent. The amount they pay off altogether is not income contingent. It is simply the fee that you're charged. The only exception to that, of course, is that if you still have not paid off your loan after 25 years, it's written off. Lovely for some, but of course in practice that means you've had 25 years when you can't get a mortgage, you're very hamstrung in terms of your everyday finances, and I don't think it's much benefit to be able to pay it off simply after 25 years. What is different between the other two parties' policies, of course, is that while the Labour Party policy at least is equally fair for all graduates, independent of what their income is, unfortunately the Conservative Party policy is even more unfair than that, because it's the poorest students, the ones who come from the poorest backgrounds, who tend to have the largest loans, Very often they don't get such well-paid jobs afterwards. Therefore, their ability to pay off their loans is much worse than those from the richer backgrounds. And so on the whole, it's the poorer backgrounds, because of this commercial rate of interest that they'll be charged under the Tory policy, it's those who come from the poorest backgrounds who end up by paying off more than the richer kids. And I think that's doubly unfortunate, doubly unfair. Our policy would be, as I say, no fees, no top-up fees, and grants of £2,000 paid for out of an extra slug of income tax, of 9% income tax, raising it from 41% to 50% on earnings of above £100,000. The significance of that, of course, is that if you happen to be the sort of graduate who uses the fact that you've got a degree to go into a very well-paid job and you earn very large sums of money, then you are forced to pay back a bit towards the cost of everybody's university education. If you're a graduate who chooses to use your degree in another way, which may be socially beneficial, for example, as a teacher, maybe as a civil servant, as a nurse, as one of the lower paid graduate jobs, then that's the way you're repaying society the debt for having given you an education. You don't pay it out of the small income that you then have. And that seems to us a much fairer way, if you like, of repaying to society the debt that you could be said to owe as a result of being provided with a higher education. Let me say, if I may, one final thing. Thank you. I have one friend in the audience. It's good to know. Thank you. Let me say one further thing about higher education. One of the things that really saddened us about the whole higher education debate as the bill went through Parliament was that all the emphasis was simply on what was a graduate degree worth to you in financial terms, and none of it was on what is the benefit of having a university education in general. And I think that's very, very sad. I see a university education as being beneficial in all sorts of social ways, to do with being a more tolerant person, with being somebody who's more likely to volunteer for voluntary work afterwards, for being the sort of person who can really benefit society in many, many ways which are not necessarily economic. And I wish that the other two parties saw higher education more in that way, and then I think we'd have a more sensible financial outcome as well. Thank you very much.
All three of our speakers for keeping to time so well. Before I throw the issues open to the floor for particular questions, I'd just like to start off a bit of a debate, picking up first this much used, though difficult to avoid, issue of choice. We've heard a great deal, not only in education, obviously in health as well, but in public policy more generally, about the evolution of the notion of choice. And there are really now almost polar opposite models of public services, either where there is a potential within a sort of quasi-market for people to choose their providers, or alternatively, for a more traditional mode, means by which the services are provided by the state and they're good enough for you not to have to worry about that. And that is almost a new ideological fault line, which I detect is actually, I'm sitting in the middle of it. So, is that true, Tim Collins? Do you feel comfortable that the Labour Party and the Conservatives appear to have a similar take, or am I misjudging both their take on it?
Well, it's not really for me to characterise the Labour position, although if that is what they're in favour of, I'm not sure that is reflected in their actions.
Right.
To distinguish my position from that taken by David, choice, I'm afraid, is not simply a desirable optional extra which you can decide to have or not to have, but focus your principal attention on whether you can provide excellence in every local community. Choice is the only lever which generates excellence in every community, and that's been worked, I'm afraid, that's been demonstrated in pretty much every field of human activity. It's only actually when you put purchase of power in the hands of individual consumers and local communities and actually enable them to exercise choice that you get a degree of uniformity and excellence around the world, whatever it is that you're looking at, whether you're looking at some of the most deprived communities or some of the most rural or sparsely populated communities. All of them actually have a high quality and pretty uniform degree of delivery in a range of things that are provided by the private sector, whether that be in terms of their access to buying a computer or having a supermarket or providing access to high quality holidays or hotels or restaurants. It's actually only when you get into the public sector that you have this huge distinction between excellence in some places and considerably less than excellence in others that you have in the United Kingdom, because we are still attached to this state monopoly idea that's been abandoned almost everywhere else in the industrialized world. We have the biggest gap between the best and the worst state schools anywhere in Europe, the biggest gap between the best and the worst state hospitals anywhere in Europe. And the old days, the only countries that used to have such huge gaps with the old Soviet Union and the planned economies, if you go for planning believing that it will deliver you equity and equality, the one thing it will never deliver you is equity.
Well, what would you do about the schools that got left behind? Because in a proper market, things get left behind, they go bankrupt, and you know, new supermarkets, newspapers, whatever it is, come up in their stead. But it doesn't work like that in educational health. I mean, what would happen to the schools which fell by the wayside?
Well, what happens at the moment is you have a situation where the focus is on saving the failing school, not saving the children who are being failed by the school. So in the present model, it's possible for a child to start at the age of 11 in a secondary school that's in special measures or is otherwise deemed to be failing, and still be in a school that's still categorised as failing when they leave at the age of 16. So yes, under our model, schools that can't perform will be forced to close. That doesn't mean those buildings will be left open. They will be taken over by a new provider. You will have somebody who will come in. Such will be the incentives for new providers to come in. We will make sure that they do. But what you can't have is the belief that by shoring up the worst performing schools and hospitals, you're doing somebody a public service. You emphatically are not.
Okay. Meghna Desai, the Labour Party has been willing to use intervention to take over, in effect, failing schools in rather the way Tim Collins is suggesting here would happen under a Conservative set of proposals. I suppose the defining difference between Labour's view of choice and the Conservatives is that the Labour Party would not allow resources to be used in the private sector. So it's a purely public sector choice model. Is that right? And whereas Tim Collins's choice extends into the private sector.
I think when people talk about choice, because of certain historic circumstances in Britain, everybody's worried that people will have to pay if you want a better school or better something or other. And while I think there's a range of facilities in which you can have choice of providers without altering the price that the consumer pays or does not pay, and other forms in which the price and the provider are both variable. Now, in secondary schools, I think it's very, very important that we stick to the state model. It is not possible to treat schools like supermarkets or anything else, because the lags between failing schools, found to be failing, shutting down and so on, and new schools coming up, there is no stock market to indicate these sorts of things. So you have to be very careful. And because you be very careful, you have to treat failed schools with a combination of good administrative or political intervention at the same time as opening out better providers, either by providing private sector support to capital expenditure of schools or in academies or letting some schools specialize. You have to provide diversity without letting people be left behind with no good schools nearby. So I think it is a difficult thing. I don't think there's a single solution. But choice in matter of subjects, of different sort of quality schools, but at the same time, no problem of having to pay. And look after failed schools in an administrative way. I don't think there's a third way.
I mean, Labour is willing in health to buy in from the private sector. I mean, not simply a miles away from
health is different, and railways are different. You know, I mean, the nature of the product is different. You can't say it's all selling widgets. You know, because the nature of the product. You know, I'm a trained economist. I know about the market. You know, and you know, the market can just be a slogan. You got to, even in a private sector, durable goods are different from non-durable goods. So health is like that.
Okay.
In health, again, people are worried that the poor may have to pay. So you have to remove that fear and then provide choice. And it's a very difficult thing to do. But that is what we're trying to do.
Okay, I want to bring... I'm going to ask David Rendell, but just to warn the audience, I want to stay with this question of choice for a little while before moving on to other parts of education. But it does seem to be choice is very important and much studied hereabouts, so I'd like to keep on with choice. But David Rendell, your party rejects both these versions of choice, in a sense, in favour of a more traditional state sector. But I'm right in saying that articulate, thoughtful parents have always been able to create a market in education, haven't they? They've moved their children around, they've found ways of going to the best schools. Work done in the LSE has shown how there is a kind of rise in house prices near the best schools. So are you not trying to stop something you can't stop?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I was interested to hear what Tim was saying about choice, because I think he's demonstrably completely wrong when he said that choice is the only way to drive up standards in schools, and that's shown across the country. Actually, if you look at what happens in secondary schools across the country, you've got patches where virtually all the secondary schools aren't very good, and other patches where virtually all the secondary schools are very good. I used to live in Fulham. I stood for Fulham twice as a parliamentary candidate. And I and my wife, at the time we lived in Fulham, were very hesitant at the thought of sending our children to the secondary schools in Fulham. We then moved to Newbury, and frankly, I would have sent my children to any of the secondary schools in Newbury very happily. They're all excellent schools, and although I was privately educated myself, I have no hesitation in saying that my children at the schools that they went to in West Berkshire got a much better education than they would have done at the independent school that I was at many years earlier. And I'm delighted that my children were properly educated in the state system rather than being educated privately. I suppose you could say I had the choice to have them educated in the state system, which was lucky for me. But it isn't true to say that choice is what drives up quality, because many parts of the country, particularly in the rural areas, frankly don't have choice and couldn't have choice. Some places are so distant from more than any one school that effectively you only can choose, unless you go into the independent sector, you only can choose that one school. And interestingly, of all the schools in West Berkshire, the one which has been rated the highest, not by myself but by other authorities, is actually the one out in the Downlands area, for which there is absolutely no choice at all. I mean, everybody around that school has to go to that school because it's simply too far to go to any other school, so there's no choice at all, and yet it is the best. The other point to make, perhaps, is that sometimes giving people a choice can actually restrict them to some extent, because, or giving them complete choice, because what is going to happen if the Tories take power is that a lot of the small village schools in my area, the small village primary schools, will close. Many of them are quite small now. If the parents are given choice, what will invariably happen is that the parents who live near a small school will say to themselves, quite likely this school's going to close. Not going to risk sending my child there, because it's quite possible that in 2 years' time the child will be thrown out of that school and have to go to a different school when the school closes. So I'll send my child to the slightly bigger school, which is in the next door village. That becomes the popular school, which everyone is allowed to choose, and under Tory plans, of course, that school will be allowed to expand to whatever size it wants. When that happens, the smaller school will get fewer and fewer pupils and very soon become non-viable altogether and will have to close. So I foresee possibly up to half the primary schools in my rural area closing if the Tories come to power next time, and that's actually going to restrict choice, not increase it.
I'll give you a chance to come back on that, Tim. Would anybody like to pick up questions about choice? I can see one here, one there, plenty of choice. Right, I have now plenty of choice. I'll go from front to back, so one, two, three, four. So I'll take them one at a time, but keep them as short as possible. In fact, you could broadly say who you are, roughly where you, you know, come from, if it's LSE or somewhere else. Do so, please.
I'm Cecilia Corona. I am the chair of UK New Cities. We're working on integration and citizenship for newcomers and workers.
Can you kind of shout just a little bit and talk both to us and to the people at the back, and we don't have any way of...
My question is about choice, but maybe other aspects of choice. Because we're talking about schools with problems, and to some extent, ethnic minority students are the responsible, in the sense that we know that practical terms, teachers and head teachers said that because of our lack of English, on cultural differences, the schools are having problems. And my question is that after the new programs about citizenship, I know in my, because my organization is working on integration and citizenship, that still immigrants, families that want to integrate better into the country don't have any kind of support for English. And that is because I'm afraid that Labour is having a very clear multicultural policy that only promotes the preservation of culture and languages inside the communities. And of course, the promotion of English as a common language, to some extent, is going to affect the cohesion of the groups. So my question is, are your parties considered the possibility to promote the question of choice also among immigrant families and support those families that want to integrate as British in this country?
Okay, interesting, good line on choice and about you want the capacity to learn English and to be and to use that as a mode of integration. Okay, so very important, clearly big urban question. I'm actually going to take another question at the same time. And yes, gentleman, long white arm. I mean, white colour, white sleeved arm. Yes, please. That's it. You.
Thanks. I'm C.J. Rice. I'm a clinical psychologist getting a second doctorate in education policy from the University of Virginia. In terms of choice, most people seem to talk about choice in terms of one school versus another. I'm wondering if there's much discussion about the choice of the headmaster in terms of hiring and firing of teachers. That seems to be a big issue in terms of the quality of schools. It's something that's restrained in the U.S. I, for example, unless I get another master's in certification, cannot teach at the lower level, even though I'm about to have two doctorates. There's a stumbling block in terms of who can actually teach. College professors cannot teach high school or lower level unless they get this certification. And it's difficult to weed out failing teachers, even though the headmaster or the principal tends to know who is the functioning person, who's the failing individual.
Okay, so the question is how much power to individual schools, in effect, and the power to organise their own resources. Okay, and I'll take one more, yep, from the back there, lady there, yep. Okay, that's a nice range of questions to get going on, and I'm going to vary the order. David, your turn to go first.
Right. I entirely take your point that I think it would be an excellent idea to give some parents the choice as to which type of education they have, whether they have one which is more English-based, on the grounds that the learning of English is a good way of helping to integrate people from the ethnic minorities into English society. Having said that, I think it is very important that those who come from the ethnic minorities do have the right to learn about the culture they come from, to bring into our English societies, good for the rest of us, let alone for those people who come from the ethnic minorities, that those good things about the cultures, the multicultures that people come from in this country now, are do form a part of our society. So I don't think we should reject those who the cultures from which people come just because some of those people may want to feel more English, more British, and may want therefore to have an education in English. But it clearly, if you're to take part in any society, it is very important to be able to speak and communicate properly in the language of that society, the main language of that society. And isn't that one of the problems that English people have when we go abroad?
All too seldom do we know the language of the societies we move to. The question of choice of a head teacher to fire and hire, it's always been our view that we should, where possible, devolve power to the lowest possible level. That's true of all aspects of our society. It's something that's fundamental to liberal democrats. We would want to devolve power as far as possible down the chain. And therefore, yes, we would like to see more power in the hands of schools where we can. But there are also aspects of school decision-making which have to be taken at a higher level, and we are not in favour of removing all the power of the LEAs to make sure that they can at least have some sort of overall oversight of the schools in their area, because it is important that we have some coordination between schools. Otherwise, we lose out on all sorts of possibilities, like peripatetic teachers going around to a variety of schools. We have what we call the Downlands Federation in my area, which is a federation of small primary schools, and it's very important that works well, because otherwise, in some of the small schools, you don't get all the variety of teaching that you should have. As for faith-based schools, it's our party's policy that faiths should be allowed to set up schools, but they should not be allowed to choose only pupils from that faith to come to the school. In other words, faith should not be one of the criteria for choosing which pupils go to that school and which don't. But we do think it's important that faiths should be allowed to set up schools and run schools which have, if you like, a religious ethos to them, a very strong ethical base, but they must be free for any child to come to.
And would that be the equivalent of, given that, I think I'm right in saying that what are called church schools, both, you'll correct me if I get this wrong, there's always been a tradition of church schools in Britain, they're largely getting their resources from the state. And you're extending that principle to religions other than the Church of England and Roman Catholics, who I think were the only ones, is that right, who have such schools?
No,
there are some. So it's extending the principle.
It would be absolutely inconceivable for a liberal to say that certain religions should be given special privileges above other religions. Okay. That would be totally against our principles.
But it's broadly that principle. Okay, make that.
Well, let me say this. On the question of power of head teachers, I think there is a great problem here. Yeah. I have seen schools in Islington long ago, a Sindh school, being transformed by the head teacher, leadership. That a lot of that happens. But that doesn't necessarily happen in a legislative framework where power devolves to the teacher. Because, as David said, lots of other people would say, a school is not a standalone thing. It is part of a group of other facilities which they share and so on. And of course, schools have to operate in presence of trade unions, which are across the country. So you can't, very often you may put a school in a very bad bargaining position if you let it bargain with everybody else. So I think, ideally, I would like a decentralized finance of schools with ability to cooperate, integrate. But we are going to be some time coming to that. On integration and faith schools, I think those are good two questions that can be taken together. I'm an atheist, and I had thought when I was young that religion would disappear before I'm too old, but that sadly has not happened. But I'm also libertarian. I think people should have whatever schools they want to have. And if you support one kind of religious faith-based school, then every faith has a right to have their own schools. You know, right now what's happening, poor parents who never taken any interest in religion are taking their toddlers to church. They're going to church pretending to be religious because they want to get into church schools. I mean, I think, it's very sad that people have to be off a religion to get it. But that is because there is excess demand for faith-based schools. And faith-based schools have not expanded enough to be able to accommodate people who do not belong to that faith. I think the important point is that whatever the schools are, faith-based schools, they should have, beyond a certain core curriculum, choice. And sometimes it leads to horrible things, like recently the report of a school, of a sect which doesn't believe in computers, does not believe in, electricity or whatever it is. I feel fine. Let there be choice. With far too much in this country, prize uniformity. And we're afraid of choice. I think lots and lots of schools, every religion ought to, people ought to invent new religions and have good schools. But How much they get of public support is another question. And I would be in favor of discriminating in favor of state schools, better financing than faith schools. But one faith schools, they can partially pay for it. That is not my party's policy. This is my policy.
No,
I hasten to add. I hasten to add. This is not a manifest commitment. But I think choice means if you want choice, you have to pay for it.
What about the question about
integration?
We could widen it out, but the question of the availability of the capacity to learn English in the school system for new migrants. I mean, it's an interesting issue, how far the government believes more generally new migrants to Britain should have access to learning about British culture and customs, which is a much bigger question than the one that was asked. Let's just keep it to English language.
I mean, you should read George Orwell's The Lion and the Unicorn. The English have a problem that they have a very low sense of nationhood. So they don't actually go around, you know, asking people to integrate. And when somebody says, like Lord Tebbit, everybody says, oh my God, that's terrible. That you should. And integration you use probably in a general way. But there are differences between integration and assimilation and multiculturalism. Different modes by which minorities may live in a community. And I think in all schools, they learn English, after all. And I'm sure, and I don't know about this, I'm sure that if people said, parents said to a school, that my child needs a special English tuition, I'd be surprised if it was not available, but I don't know. My children, unfortunately, knew a lot of English, went to state schools, and integrated. But some people may not want to integrate. You've got to realize that some people want to live here, but not necessarily integrate. And I think we've got to respect their choice. So we have to, again, like in the faith school, have a minimum core commitment for integration, but then leave a lot of choice to people.
Okay. And Tim Collins, sorry you've been kept out of this for a long time.
On the issue of the teaching of English, there obviously has to be a balance that is struck in all our approaches to these issues between individual choices on the one hand and what's in the wider interest of society as a whole on the other, and a balance between focusing on those things that differentiate us from our neighbours and those things that bring us together. My own view is that the pendulum has swung far too far away from those things that make us all share something in common, and the English language is something that the vast majority of people in this country either can or could or should share in common as a means at least of being able to communicate with each other. So it seems to me to be difficult to think of a higher spending priority within the education department than making sure that everybody who wants to learn English and be fluent in English, whether or not that's their original mother tongue or whether or not they actually want it to be the language that they normally use at home, but if they want to be able to use that out on the streets or in their workplaces or for their future career prospects, that must be something that we do actually take the view that we should strongly encourage. I'm not even, to be quite honest, sure I entirely agree with my colleague here that those who want to live here but not integrate at all should be respected in their right to do that. I do actually think that if you're going to be resident in a country, you should actually have at least some sense of commonality with your neighbours. It doesn't mean uniformity, it doesn't mean losing your sense of a community, but I do actually think we should strongly take the view, virtually every other country on the Earth surface does after all, that there are at least some things that bind us together. So that's my view on that one. On the issue of head teachers, that's slightly, and power for them, it is very reminiscent, all these debates, I have to say, of the debates that we used to have 20 or 30 years ago as to why in every individual special circumstance, although in theory it was a nice idea to give management the right to manage, and although in theory it was a good idea to say that it would be sensible to have choice or market principles, in practice, here was a special example where it wouldn't apply. At the time when it was debated about the denationalisation of telecoms in this country, very much the same sort of scare stories that we heard from David earlier were advanced, that of course it would be impossible to have a telephone line into every community in the country because it would never make sense to do it into rural areas. And of course, if you went down the route of allowing the market into something as fundamental to public service as the idea of providing telecommunications, there will be large tracts of the country that would be cut off and would have no access to phone boxes, and businesses in certain rural areas that would have to wait years before they could get a telephone connected and all the rest of it. I have to say, broadly speaking, my argument on all this is actually human nature is not fundamentally different. It does make sense for managers to be able to manage whether they are running a business or whether they're running a school. If you go in and talk to virtually every head teacher in any school these days, they will say to you they believe, for better or for worse, and some of them welcome this and some of them don't, but they do believe that these days they are running a business, and in order to run that business right and correctly and well, they should be given the management tools to do that, and that includes the management tools that until 20 or 30 years ago we denied an awful lot of managers up and down the land in British business, which is the right to hire and to fire. And that is something that, as in British business, would result actually over time in far better workplaces and far more productive workplaces too. Finally, on the issue of the lady, I think she identified herself as from the British Humanist Association. You can argue the case for faith schools actually either way, and I'll come on to the way that I would argue it from a humanist perspective if you want, but I actually take the view, I am actually somebody who has a faith, who believes in the spiritual dimension. I think it's very interesting that the two other panellists have said there's this extraordinary phenomenon whereby all these parents who don't have faith want to send their children, for some bizarre reason, to faith schools. Well, just possibly that's because these faith schools quite clearly, on all the records and all the Ofsted secular assessments, do much better than normal state schools in terms of exam performance, do much better than normal state schools in terms of the ethos there, and that is actually because having a spiritual dimension, whether you happen to share it or not, is actually something that very often makes that school a very attractive place for parents to send their children to. So I would actually argue that on the basis both of choice and on the basis of excellence. But in response to the lady who's a humanist, it is, after all, consistent with my approach, and I think actually proven by experience. If you want to kill something off, nationalise it. There's far more faith around in the United States where they ban school prayer than there is in the United Kingdom where it's technically compulsory. So actually, I would say to you, if you actually are worried about the spread of faith, you keep very sure that it is in the state system. That's the real way to keep it under the thumb and make sure it doesn't grow, because the state is incapable of running anything effectively, including belief in God.
So you won't want to be running the state then in a few weeks' time. No, I merely joke. Right, I'm sure you do it. You'd say you would. Now, two more on choice, then I want to move on. Young man, man there, and then one here. You said, yep. It is you, yes, sorry.
Sorry, this is, do you believe, that you definitely believe that they ought to teach in schools more practical-based skills, and here I mean, instead of the usual lens in terms of planning work, things such as handling tax and specific debt, which was really credit card problems that we encountered. Do they believe that to be a compulsory?
So kind of what you might call modern civic and sort of personal management business skills. Okay, fine. And here, yes.
I'll have to turn my back on you, sorry to...
Yes, no, if you tilt yourself round, that'd be good.
Mine is Martin Rowland. I spent years in further education. The discussion on choice seems to centre on quality and the right of managers to manage. In 1994, under a conservative administration, colleges were incorporated. So colleges became independent employers in their own right. And 11 years later, over half of them are in financial trouble. About a third of them are in serious financial trouble. And the quality issues are probably just as bad with pockets of excellence and pockets of dire performance as they ever were. I would welcome the panelists' views on applying that same principle to schools and whether the outcome might be exactly the same.
Can I just, before putting that to panel, put a question back to you. Do you think that that's possibly because of the continuing Cinderella nature of further education compared with the enormous attention generally spent here as elsewhere on schools and universities? Or is it because of the mechanism that you're saying? That's
my personal view is it's the mechanism.
All right.
And it's putting market forces into a service which is not normally market driven.
Okay.
And putting it into the hands of people who are not philosophical. Tied up to the market agenda, and it goes wrong.
Okay, point Lord Brown made at BP recently, to be fair. As people of all parts of politics can think. I'll take one more on this, then I want to come back to the panel quickly and then move on to higher education.
I understand that I'm immigrant. I grew up in Scotland.
Can you project yourself to the people at the back a bit,
sure,
if you could.
I am the son of an immigrant. I grew up in Glasgow as a Scotsman. I hated the English. I thought Scotland would always be England and Scotland. Now, what's happening now with the Asian community? I think your children are at risk of growing up being Asian and English. Now, that won't work. These children are British. They may be called up for the army. If Britain was involved with an Asian country war, they would have to be British soldiers. And I think the policy is wrong, but in the demand of the Asian population wanting their children to continue in their background and not become truly and completely British citizens.
Okay, thank you very much. And that's... I'm going to ask Meghnad to answer that first, because it's an almost direct challenge to something that you said. Meghnad.
I think... I believe there are multiple identities we all carry. It is not an either-or choice. I have about 15 identities, which I will not bother to tell you. But the fact that I was born in India... work here, married first an English woman, then an Indian woman. My children are more British, but they know something about India. I don't think we need to face people those choices. You are Scotsman and you are British.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, no doubt you have many more things because of your father and things like that.
Yes.
So I think what we need to do is to take the heat out of this. People should have certain commitment in the public sphere to elements of British citizenship. The reason why it is difficult, because as I said before, we have never defined what a British citizenship is until David Blunkett started fussing about it. We had big empire. There was idea that we were all subjects, not citizens. And the whole notion of citizenship in Britain historically is a very weak one. And because it was an open country, had also the refugees and immigrants coming here, never insisted that you had to be British, declared to be British. America is very different. Britain is very different. But I think what David Blunkett is doing, or started doing, is basically, yes, if you want to become a citizen, certain minimum commitments have to be done. But we do not need to give up what your private belongings, your culture, and so on. I think people can speak more than one language. People can hold more than one culture.
But you do think that there is a kind of minimal British cultural engagement, even if people hold on to their background.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, those of you who have seen John Ford films, Western films, when people become citizens, they have to swear by the Constitution in America. I think I agree with the lady. They have to know English. At a minimum, they know something about the Constitution. But they don't have to like Bangers and Mash.
And chap at the back asked a question about, as it were, learning about
There's a lot of that happening anywhere. But the fact that people learn about debt and so on doesn't mean they don't get into debt. I mean, people should learn about all this, but, you know, I don't actually worry about people getting into debt at all. That's how the modern development took place, through debt. It's all been balancing our budgets. We'll still be hunters and gatherers. Now, on this, I want to say something about the further education. I think what you're really saying is that if independence is to be fostered, you do it with some sort of cushion, so the transition to independence is gradual and not sudden. And you certainly don't take all the money away. You kind of, because I think independence is a good thing, but you don't leave people completely, on their own. And you make quite sure that there is some financial strategy behind the transition. And there will always be a quality difference between good and bad. It's true in supermarkets. Why should we throw schools? I mean, why are we afraid of diversity of quality? Why do you want everything of uniform quality? I know of nothing in the world which is, and what is extraordinarily dull, like McDonald's.
Okay, thanks. Tim Collins, I think the Conservative Party has recently published a document about personal debt or commissioned paper
Lord
from
Griffiths.
Lord Griffiths. So the
a
issue that was
lecturer.
Raised, a former LSE, another former LSE person, inevitably. So, since how far would the Conservatives like to, as it were, use an already crowded national curriculum that's articulated to put more of these issues right down into the schools, or is it overloading the curriculum?
Well, I think you started exactly where I was going to start. I think in fairness, all three of the political parties that are represented here recognise now that over the years, and this is certainly a joint responsibility both of the last Conservative government as well as the present Labour government, we've ended up with a curriculum that is already over-prescriptive, that takes up too much of teachers' time. It presently represents about 80% of the time in schools. We are of the view that we should see that reduced to a maximum of 50% and hopefully below that. So we're not casting around looking for lots of extra things to put in, but there is, of course, already within the curriculum, as presently specified, there is what's called personal and social education, which is supposed to involve, alongside the citizenship part of the curriculum, it's supposed to involve addressing some of the issues that you're talking about. And I certainly think it would be sensible for there to be material available for both pupils and teachers to have to talk about some of these issues. I'm not quite as relaxed about the huge explosion either in public or in personal debt we've seen in recent years as my colleague from the Labour Party, but then that's perhaps not very surprising.
Because I'm an economist.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm an economist.
And we all know that all economists all take one view and never disagree with each other. But there are plenty of economists, we've heard one quoted, who share our concern about the very rapid increase in personal debt. But I do actually agree that it's not as simple as just taking the view that if you had a couple of lessons in the classroom, people wouldn't run up debt. I mean, there's obviously much more complicated factors that lie behind that. On the question of the FE colleges, I'm sure you're right, it's certainly true that Parliament has been lobbied repeatedly, and in fact only a few days ago, most recently, by the Association of Colleges, making it clear that they do still feel that the present system is very heavily weighted against them. It's perfectly legitimate for you to say that the present structure of colleges, in terms of self-government, was put in place 11 years ago under a Conservative government. You'll equally not be surprised if I point out that it doesn't mean that 8 of those 11 years haven't had a Conservative government, and therefore I think there is perhaps a degree of responsibility for others rather than just us for the present situation they find themselves. Many of the things they are concerned about actually have very little to do with whether they are run by local authorities or run themselves. They have to do with the equality or lack of it of funding between schools and FE colleges on a like-for-like basis. They have to do with the complexity of the funding formulae through which they have to battle in order to get money from the Further Education Funding Council. And they also have to do with the fact I was hearing about one FE college only today that has seen a 29% increase in the number of adult students, but only a 1% increase in its funding. Now, my point is that that is not an instance of a system that's gone too far towards market principles. That's a system that clearly hasn't gone remotely far enough, because surely in any sensible market, if you have a 29% increase in the number of people going through your door, you wouldn't be doing very well if you only had a 1% increase in your funding. It might not be exactly the same as 29%, but you'd expect it to be more than 1%. So I would argue that moving, as we would advocate, towards actually having funding following the adult preference and actually being attached to the student or the potential student would be more likely to help FE colleges rather than winding the clock back and putting them under local education authorities. There was a third question, I've forgotten it.
It was the gentleman here.
Indeed, absolutely. I'm sorry, on the issue indeed about integration. I think you were coming from a very similar perspective to what I was saying earlier, so I think we have to focus a little bit more on what unites us rather than all the things that divide us. And that is irrespective of where people come from or what the colour of their skin is or what their accent is or what their first language is. What brings us, the reason surely we are all together in this island is that we, or at least our parents or our grandparents, decided that we wanted to live together in this island. So there must have been something that actually attracted us all to wanting to be here. With these days, with porous borders and much more easy travel, it's perfectly possible for lots of people to leave this island if they want to, while we're all here, let's actually focus on some of the things that we have in common and the things that we can do together, rather than just focusing on all the ways that we're actually different from the people down the road.
Okay, and David Rennell, you've been left out for a bit now. I'm sorry about this.
That's all right. Thank you. First of all, on the question about skills, while the question was being written, was being asked, I was writing down too much in the national curriculum. So I think Tim was absolutely right to mention the fact that if we try to put everything into the national curriculum, then we're going to get totally overburdened, or the national curriculum will get totally overburdened, and schools will find it impossible to do. So although I would strongly support young people being taught these more practical skills, I'm not sure it should be a part of the compulsory program, and I think schools should be given a certain choice, dare I say it, in what they do teach and how they teach it. Actually, if I were to look at one set of skills which I would put into any school curriculum ahead of financial skills, it would be parenting skills. Seems to me that's the biggest lack of all in our school programs at present, and one of the reasons why, sadly, most parents learn on their first child, get a bit better by the time they come to the second child. If you're a third child, you're probably lucky because your parents have probably learned a bit about it by that time. And of course, not many people nowadays have as many as three children, so we're tending to find parenting, perhaps parenting skills, even more lacking now than they used to be. On the question that Martin Rowland asked, I think I can only say I entirely agree with the implication of your question, that I can't see any reason for incorporating the schools in future. On the question about immigration and whether we should, so to speak, throw away where we come from in order to assimilate totally with a community or a society into which we've moved, I tend to agree with Lord Desai on this one, that I think we are all many parts. I personally was born in Greece, and although I left Greece when I was only 2 months old, I had Greek dual nationality for a long time. And I was very proud when Greece won the European Cup, in spite of my rather poor connections with the country nowadays. I'm a quarter Scottish and three quarters English. I tend, therefore, to support England against Scotland when we play them at various sports, and I certainly support England against Wales, and I'm bloody angry about what happened in the rugby this year. But I'm also a European, and when it comes to the Ryder Cup, I'd certainly support Europe against the United States. I feel part of all those groups, and perhaps most importantly of all, I'm a human being. And one of the lessons that I felt I learned very strongly when I went on VSO, Voluntary Services Overseas, as a young man in my gap year, was that there is so much more that joins the nations and the races of this world together than what separates them. And how important it is for us all to remember, not whether we're British, English, Scottish, European, or whatever else, but we're all human beings.
Okay, right. Now I want to move us on, thank you, David, I want to move us on to higher education. Not going to structure this particularly, only to point out that we have three distinct political positions on higher education and student funding. I'm not sure I fully understand all of them completely, but that's just doubtless my stupidity. And clearly a substantial debate about whether or not particular approaches are or are not more or less regressive. So, just with that minor amount of framing, would anybody like to address a particular question? And I need to make the point on his behalf that Meghnad Desai has to leave for a commitment made earlier. So I'm going to take him first. So I'll take a couple of questions and then ask him to answer and then move on to the others. Gentleman here, and then, yes, lady here. Yeah.
How many graduates does the UK need?
Sorry?
How many graduates does the UK need? Can you kind of...
There is no answer to that question.
I can see where you're getting at.
There is never, ever any answer to questions like that.
Give us a bit more detail. Yeah. I know what you're getting at. But
the proportion of the population should have a
graduate. I mean, are you asking the question politely, is the Labour Party's figure of 50% a good or a bad one? Is that?
Yes, but it's such a
No, right. Okay. Fine. No, that's the question. It's very clear. Okay. Lady here.
Yep. Providing for my family. family 28, 9, even 10 hours per day, and having 2 or 3 hours per study, that I don't have any kind of loan because I should be a part-time student. So please, I need some kind
Good question, but why is it different for a migrant than it would be for anybody else? I mean, isn't it a problem faced?
You're saying just a lot of immigrants do have part-time needs.
No, I'm just checking. I mean, it's a good question. I'm just checking I've understood it, really, rather like the previous gentleman. And the third one there, very briefly.
I'm wondering if any of the policies take the economy into account, that usually when an economy is poor, there's more unemployment, more people are interested in going back at that point and getting a degree. And then when it's picking up and there are lots of jobs available, that's when they start getting jobs. And, I'm wondering if
okay, thanks. Meghna Desai, Labour does have this 50% target. I mean, given that you yourself joined in to say there wasn't a right figure, how do you think they came to a figure of 50%?
Well, 50% is people having access to higher education. And I think, you know, it's a number which, you know, if you had said 30% when I first started in higher education 40 years ago, people died laughing. We only 8% were in higher education. Now we're at 30% because it's been made possible partly by the Great Education Reform Bill, to which many of us are kind of martyrs, that the Conservatives passed, and partly because of the proliferation of, you know, higher education facilities. Now, I think, you know, I could go on about globalization and we need more skilled people and so on, but there is no doubt that Britain is an undereducated country. I've no doubt about that. And I think, I don't believe in either manpower planning or targets, but eventually higher and higher would be a good thing. I also believe at the same time in the fact that people should pay for it. And so whoever goes there actually knows that it is worth their while going, and the cyclical problem that other gentlemen mentioned is sorted out that way. You know, right now we have a problem that, you know, part-time people don't get any money and so on, because higher education hogs up far too much money. You know, very comfortable people are going to make lots and lots of money. And I know David said they're going to, you know, sing songs for, you know, for the country and do culture and all that. Well, fine. Other people do that as well, who have not had the privilege of going to higher education. And they are paying for these people not only to do all that, but earn lots and lots of money. I feel, pay for it. You know, my part is halfway there. But I think targets are nice things for governments to have. But the world doesn't work like that. Outcomes are decided by what people choose to do. And what we have to do is make it clear to people that they ought to get higher education, not only at one stage of life, but later on they ought to be reskilling and getting new qualifications, because that's the nature of the modern economy. We're not going to have any manufacturing left in about 10 years' time, seriously. You know, because there are other people who can manufacture better than us at lower cost. So we've got to get into high R&D, high education intensive jobs. The world doesn't own us a living. We've got to work hard, educate, re-educate, and reskill to be able to survive. And that is why the 50% target is a good target.
Are you convinced that the current offerings from universities are going to meet that requirement, you know, in terms of, you know, the course offerings?
Well, things will change. You know, things will change when there's more diversity of provision in our universities. Right now, there's far too much uniformity. And everybody thinks they're Oxbridge. Sorry, I've got to leave.
I know you have. Thank you, Meghna.
Nothing that I've said is a policy of Labour Party.
Tim Collins, I think your party has a view that, in a sense, 50% is probably not an appropriate target. But is that, I mean, in terms of the question of how many?
I can actually not only, I hope, answer that question, I can answer the last question that you put to Lord Desai, which was, how did the Labour Party come up with this? Because probably by mistake, because I think it's the only instance where they have provided a straight answer to a request under the Freedom of Information Act, but they provided a straight reply to this. They published the minutes of the meeting at which this 50% target was arrived at. and it was arrived at a meeting that took place at No. 10 Downing Street, at which present were the Prime Minister, the then Education Secretary, and various political advisers. There was no civil servant present, there was no employer present, there was no academic present. They came up with the 50% target simply because presentationally it sounded good, and for no other reason than that, and that in and of itself is a reason for abandoning it, and we would do so. When, however, you ally to that the fact that although employer organisations do strongly agree with Lord Desai that we are an undereducated nation and that we have problems with our skills, but they do not agree at all that the problem is that we don't have enough graduates. On the contrary, we have more graduates in our workforce than any other country on the Earth's surface. And yet, we have major skill shortages in the UK economy, and those skill shortages are growing. Furthermore, the research, there's more research to this effect coming out quite shortly, but just to quote the stuff that's already been published, the research is clear that graduates are finding it more and more difficult to find graduate-level employment. And actually, there's a survey that indicated a third of all graduates 2 years after graduating in the UK are not finding graduate-level employment. So yes, we need to invest in skills, and yes, we need to invest in training, but actually not by ever more expansion in higher education. And indeed, there are some serious questions that need to be asked about some of the courses that are being laid on. It was actually a Labour higher education minister who described them as Mickey Mouse courses. I think that's a somewhat provocative phrase, but nonetheless, I think we all know what was lying behind that particular thought. I actually think our friend on the front row who's dealing with the further education sector probably is in the area where we most need to invest in some of our skills upgrading. And some of the issues that we were talking about before in terms of skills, vocational skills in schools and so forth. Now, that's not a reason for saying, let's sort of shut down the whole of higher education, let's not have any more graduates, let's actually reverse the whole of the expansion, as Lord Desai quite rightly said, started when my lot were in office. The big growth, which was from about one in 12, when we came into office, all the way up to 1 in 3, took place when there was a Conservative government. The further growth from roughly 33% to about 43% has happened in the last 8 years. Our view is simply that that is sufficient, that 43%, the target, that the level that we're likely to inherit, is about right. We're not proposing a massive reduction in that, but we're not proposing further to grow it. And we are saying that as far as higher education is concerned, they need to pause on this breakneck expansion and this focus on quantity and actually have a period of focus on quality. And as far as skills in the economy are concerned, we must listen to the fact that every single employer organisation, without exception, all of them, the Chambers of Commerce, the CBI, the Institute of Directors, they hardly agree on anything else, but they all agree they don't want ever more graduates going into the workforce. They actually want the state to focus actually on other levels of skills, both amongst adults and amongst the 18 to 30 age group. And so that's what we would seek to do.
OK, very clear. Now, David Rendell, your party hasn't, I think I'm fair to say, got involved in the 50% too many, too few debate, but, I mean, how would you come to a number if you were to come to a number, or would you not?
I think the obvious and immediate and quick answer to that is that we wouldn't. But let me, if I may, say one thing which immediately struck me, partly about the question and in particular about Tim's answer, and that is that I think both fell absolutely slap bang into the trap of thinking that the only point of higher education is, are you going to get a job as a result? And I just do not think that that is a sensible way to look at higher education. Higher education has many values which are useful to our society as a whole, which go well beyond whether that particular course takes you into employment thereafter or not. And it's the wrong way to look at it, to say, how many do we need? Because actually, in a sense, the more the better. And that is actually true, interestingly, even for economic purposes, because if you look across the industrialized nations, it's invariably those which have the highest levels of education in general which are prospering the most. But even if that wasn't the case, it is nevertheless the case that it is beneficial to our society, I strongly believe, that we should have as many people educated to graduate level as we can. Now, the difficulty is that not everybody, A, is qualified to go on into higher education, and B, probably can make good use of a higher education course. Sadly, there are some individuals who just probably are not intellectually capable of taking on a higher education course. And therefore, what we would say
is that what we ought to do is get as many people going on at school beyond the age of 16 as we can, and anybody who is then capable of getting a level 3 qualification should have the opportunity to move on thereafter to a level 4 qualification as well. Now, that may be 50%, it may be 60%, it may be 40%. I suspect, if anything, in the long term, it'll probably turn out to be more than 50%. But we're not setting a target of any sort. We're not saying 50% is the right level. We're not saying 60% is the right level. We're simply saying that all those who are capable of going on to a level 4 qualification after a level 3 qualification, qualified to do so, should have the chance to do so. There was a question then about part-time student support. I'm happy to say that it's my party's policy that part-time students should have exactly the same pro rata support as full-time students. So they shouldn't be having to pay fees, and they should have, if they come from that proportion of the population, they should have grants in proportion to the amount of studying they're doing at university. So there would be, under our system, more support for part-timers as well as full-timers. And it is very important. It's not just immigrants at all. It's all sorts of people who, for various different reasons, it is suitable to them to study part-time rather than full-time. It may be that they need to earn some money meanwhile. Maybe they have a family. Maybe they have other responsibilities which make it difficult for them to study full-time. And they ought to be given a chance to study part-time on a fair basis. The policies take the economy into account, flexibility of the numbers going? I think it's very, very difficult to see how you could really make very flexible the number of places that are on offer in the university system. I mean, that would mean either sort of, depending on how the economy is going, closing down certain courses overnight almost and then opening up other ones as the demand grows. I think that has to be a fairly gradual process. I just don't think it's practical to make very big changes in the number of university places that there are available in short term in relation to the state of the economy. But I do entirely agree with you. It's certainly the case that when the economy is not doing badly, there may well be opportunities for the universities to put on more courses on a gradual basis over time.
Okay, now we're approaching 7:30. In fact, we're very close to 7:30. So, there was one question at the back there. Yes, you've been waiting patiently. And one other we haven't had a question from, and then I'm afraid that must be it. So, yeah, please.
I was going to say I agree with Tim Collins on this matter. I think that the government should realise that these percentages are means to an end, not an end to a means. It's no good throwing these percentages in our face, saying, look at what we've achieved. Because at the end of the day, that's not what it's about. It's about the results. And then it's just the results of these those percentages.
Heaven forbid. Yeah, can't possibly be true.
It's not totally about that. I mean, I agree to some extent how the Liberal Democrat was saying that it's about an overall education bringing something to society, but that's not what people look at university as about. They choose the course that they think. People don't choose their course and then choose their university based on the best university for that course. They choose their university where they think they're going to have the best time. Then they choose a course they think they're going to get into. Now, I'm telling you, you don't shake your head because I know people.
All right, now, can you, hang on. Come to it, can you give us a question, or are you just, it's an interesting.
I mean, I welcome your comments on, like,
okay.
Whether you think the government should look towards what Germany's introduced, a sort of more vocational program, like
okay. Okay. Be good. Thank you. And there was one other. Try and be a bit shorter if you could. Yeah.
5 years ago, I left a state secondary school, which, let's just say, I didn't like. There was a culture of not learning. Basically, most of the pupils there, really, if you looked like that, you wanted to excel and work hard, you were picked on and you had no chance over a 5 year period. One section, many people talk about the lowest 10% helping, but what about the top 10% who are going to be running the country and doing the very hard jobs? Isn't there a case to put forward that you put them separately so they can excel and go much faster and actually get into society much earlier? Because you say that having smart people in the class, sorry, by people who bring them down will try and bring them up, not the case. What happens is people not pick on them and then the whole class get behind them and just destroy them around.
Are you subtly asking whether grammar schools should be reintroduced?
Yes, yes.
No, I mean, there's nothing, just checking out again. Okay, fine. Well, there's a nice, easy, non-controversial question to finish with, gentlemen. Can I interpret the first question as to some extent, how far would it be possible to, and it's picking up a point that was made earlier on, how far would it be possible to enhance elements of further education to produce, as it were, there's clearly demands for an array of skills in the economy, which all politicians accept are needed, most of which are delivered through FE, and yet FE remains a struggle. It is not given the prominence that the rest of education is. There is no effort to have an elite FE sector, or part of the FE sector. So question, I mean, should we be taking our focus a bit off HE and moving it on to getting these high skills out of further education? Second question, the easy one, grammar schools. David Rendell.
In answer to the first question, I mean, clearly, I haven't talked much about FE at all, which is perhaps a pity and demonstrates a failure on my part. But certainly, I think what our party would say is that what is important is to try to make sure that the so-called vocational skills training and the so-called more academic skills training should be much better integrated together. And that's one of the reasons why we're so much in favour of the Tomlinson proposal, because we feel they were aimed specifically at that. And the great difficulty at present is that you have got, as I was saying right at the beginning, these separate ladders at present. You've got an academic ladder and a vocational ladder. And we need to make sure that there's much greater flexibility in order to be able to move around a climbing frame of education, taking on perhaps some courses which are part educational, part academic, part more vocational courses. And we need to make sure that that is integrated both at the 14 to 19-year-old level and indeed in higher education as well, so that we get a better integration of further and higher education. Further education in the past has been mostly concerned with vocational skills, higher education much more with the more academic skills, and we don't think that that separation is good for the country. You did say, though...
Hang on.
Sorry. You did say, you indicated that it was almost that your way of evaluating higher education was simply in terms of the numbers of papers published. I don't accept that any more than I think higher education is purely in terms of what jobs you're going to get at the end. I think there are much greater values for society as a whole, and I think we ought to look at all those when we're trying to decide how many people should get a university education, or should be offered, should I say, a university education. And if I shook my head when you say that people choose their university and then decide what course to go in, and you indicated that you thought you were much closer to it than I was, let me tell you, not only have I had 3 children go to university within the last 5 years, so I've seen quite a lot of how universities are chosen and courses are chosen, but of course they're all of the age group where all their friends have been going through universities, and of course as higher education spokesperson, I go around a lot of universities and talk to thousands of students. So I do have, I think it's fair to say, a little bit of knowledge about how people choose what they do.
Hold on.
But let me go on to the other question. I mean, where's the gentleman? I'm sorry. Yes, there. You were clearly at a bad secondary school. And there are bad secondary schools. There are plenty of bad secondary schools.
According to Ofsted, it's quite a good secondary school.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily trust Ofsted. I've not had much time for Ofsted for some while, and it's our party's policy to get rid of it. But no, I think the fact of the matter is there are plenty of bad secondary schools in this country. And you suffered as a result of going to a bad secondary school. No question about that from what you say. But not all secondary schools are bad. Secondary schools don't have to be bad. As I said earlier, all the secondary schools, every one of the secondary schools in West Berkshire is a very good school. And I can tell you of many, many examples of kids who are extremely bright, who've gone through the secondary schools in West Berkshire, have had no feeling they're being held back at all. On the contrary, good encouragement to go through pretty academic courses, to get good results in their exams and so on, and to go on to the most prestigious universities there are in the country. So it is not inevitable
that the present secondary school system can't work. It doesn't always work, and it doesn't work particularly in some of our inner cities, and that's the problem we've got to solve.
Grammar schools?
No.
Grammar schools. Hang on, we're going to have to pick it up afterwards. We're running late, and I want to try and finish in 2 or 3 minutes. Tim Collins, there were two questions there, one of which was my interpretation of the first point, second, the grammar schools point.
Well, I think what the gentleman at the back was saying really was that we need to recognise that at least for some young people who are contemplating university, it's neither David's sense of public service or of widening the mind that's influencing them, nor is it the simple utilitarian question about how much money they can earn later on. And I think we have to be realistic about that, and we have to make sure that we are not sending out a signal, this is another reason why I oppose the 50% target, sending out a signal which implies that the only people of any wealth or ambition or attainment or intelligence are those that actually go to university. I think that's a very dangerous signal for us to send. If you look at actually all the significant companies in the FTSE 100 index, almost all of them were founded by people who were not graduates. If you look at some of the people who've made some astonishingly large contributions to our nation's cultural environment and all the rest of it, very often they're not graduates either. So we must get away from the idea that the only thing that has a value is university. That can have a value, of course, but it's not the only thing of value, not the only valid career choice to make at the age of 18. As far as the gentleman who was concerned about not only the focus, which often, quite rightly he says, he's quite correct in saying, the focus very often in the public debate is on the third or so at the bottom of the academic league table, if you like, who are often let down by the UK system and have been let down for 150 years. I think he's quite right to say there are serious issues about some of the very, very bright people who would do extremely well in a system if they're given sufficient support. I am very much in favour of saying that there should be much more screening within schools. You can argue about whether there should be more grammar schools. My party's policy is to set schools free. So that would mean that there probably would be more grammar schools than there are now, but it wouldn't be a return to universal selection, and the vast majority of head teachers in secondary schools at the moment don't want to convert their schools into grammar schools, so since we would leave it up to them, that would be unlikely to happen. I think the more interesting issue, and the one that would apply to many more people, would certainly perhaps have applied in your case, sir, is if you actually had, within comprehensive schools, a much wider use of academic streaming, so that those that are actually within that school amongst the most talented and those that have got the greatest potential, whether that be for higher education or for other things, are able to be taught in classes that actually bring them together and have a climate where there is an enthusiasm for learning and there is support for learning, and where you and others do not feel that somehow you are unique or that you're somehow uncool or you're disconnected from your peers just because you are actually interested in picking up a book. And I think we've got to cover that. And the final thing is, as a culture and as a society, we've actually got to get back to valuing rather less, perhaps, those who are very talented at kicking a football around, and rather more those that actually have a degree of learning and a degree of mental agility. I think as a culture, we have moved away from sensible values in many respects, and we are valuing and hero-worshipping people who may be very good at what they do, but what they do actually is much less socially valuable or actually interesting for the future of us as a species, let alone as a society, than actually the things that we used to value when we valued the people who led the breakthroughs in biology and engineering and business and all these other things. So a little bit less about Mr. Beckham and a little bit more about people who, in my judgment anyway, are doing a little bit more for the future of our country and indeed our world.
Right, thank you both very much. Thank you all for coming this evening. Clearly, this is a sort of pre-election meeting, and a great opportunity to listen to leading politicians explaining a small range of the educational issues that will undoubtedly be debated in the weeks up to an imagined general election on May the 5th. Mustn't assume it will happen. I'd like to thank Meghnad Desai, Tim Collins, David Rendell for coming here this evening, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming this evening, for joining in, and for asking such spirited questions. I've no doubt for the poor MPs you'll be able to grab them before they can get to the door if you have anything else to ask them. other than that, safe journey home. Thank you very much.